Talk Cheese.
Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Sink for Eli James. Eli won't begin tonight. I have Greg Howard here with me. This is Friday, October 22nd, 2010, and this is Chris DeGinnos. We'll be discussing, well, Eli and I discussed Ezekiel chapter 38 last week at great length. We're going to, I'd like to give Ezekiel 38 a quick recap and then do Ezekiel chapter 39 and have a good discussion of that. Hello, Greg. Praise Yahweh. How are we doing tonight?
Praise Yahweh, Bill. Good to be here.
Wonderful. Okay, I'm going to get right into it. First, I've said a lot of this stuff before, but I think it's important, so I like to keep repeating myself, right, basically. And all of these prophecies from Ezekiel 33:21 through the end of chapter 39 were all written at the same time. That could be pretty safely told because Ezekiel always started his prophecies with the date that he was writing them and has not changed his date or given us any indication that these aren't one consistent prophecy from 33:21 through the end of chapter 39. And in 33:21, that was the 12th year of the captivity when Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. And the next break is after chapter 39, and that's at chapter 40. That's the 25th year of the captivity, 13 years later. So, and as I hypothesized last week, these chapters of Ezekiel from 34 through 39, being all written at the same time, should be understood as a unit, and they also correlate to other similar end times prophecies, such as Revelation chapter 20, which I'm going to read here in a moment. Revelation chapter 20 summarizes Ezekiel 38 and 39. I think that these are all one unit. We have in chapter 34, we have the story of the lost sheep. In chapters 35 and 36, we see that the Edomites have assumed their identity by assuming their nations, by moving into their nations and claiming their heritage for themselves. In chapter 37, we see the assembly of the dry bones, right, and their restoration. And I believe that that's something that happens as we progress through history, our restoration becomes imminent. And in Ezekiel 38 and 39, we see that, and I believe that I could interpret this, that as soon as we finally realize who we are and those bones do come back to life fully, that we're surrounded by our enemies and there's not much we could do about it. And that's what Ezekiel 38 and 39 describe. However, Yahweh destroys them all, and that's what Ezekiel 38 and 39 promise. I'd like to read Revelation chapter 20 because Revelation chapter 20 is exactly parallel to this story. And I saw a messenger descending from out of heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he held fast the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the false accuser and the adversary, or Satan. And he bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and barred and set a seal upon it that he may no longer deceive the nations until the 1,000 years should be completed. After these, it is necessary for him to be released for a short time. And anybody waiting for some evil creature to come and deceive our people, that person is himself deceived right now. For right now, the true Satan, the Antichrist Jew, has indeed deceived the whole world. This 1,000-year binding of Satan happened when the Jew was excoriated from Christian society at the time of the early church under the emperors who passed laws excoriating the Jew. And that happened in the time of Justinian and in the time of, well, before that, in the time of Theodosius I and II, and even from the time of Constantine. That process took a couple of hundred years to culminate, and in the 1500s, when the De Medicis infiltrated the church and got themselves elected popes, well, they were also bankers and pharmacists, and they actually lifted a lot of the restrictions on Jews, which allowed the Jews to begin to crawl out of that pit, and that culminated with the French Revolution. From verse 4, and I saw thrones, and they who sat upon them, and judgment had been given to them, and the souls of those having been beheaded on account of the testimony of Yahshua and on account of the word of Yahweh, who did not worship the beast nor his image, and did not receive the inscribed mark upon their foreheads and upon their hands, and they lived and ruled with Christ 1,000 years. These are the Christian martyrs who were venerated throughout this entire period, throughout the entire Middle Ages. This is the first restoration. That's all that chapter 5 should read. I'm sorry, that verse 5 should read is, this is the first restoration. I understand that the King James Version has resurrection there, but the word means restoration. And the rest of the verse, having to do with bodies of the dead living again, that was added by a monk named Andreas of Caesarea, who lived in the Middle Ages, and it doesn't appear in Scripture until around the 9th or 10th century AD. It does not belong in Scripture. Blessed is he, blessed and holy is he, having a part in the first restoration. Over these, the second death does not have authority. Their spirits live, right? But they shall be priests of Yahweh in Christ, and shall rule with him for 1,000 years. And they did. If you have any comment, Greg, just cut in.
Well,
in the South.
Okay. But you want to keep reading, or the only comment
well,
that I had so
to say, let's hear it.
Yeah.
The
comment that I had, two comments. One, it's obvious that the 1,000 years have taken place because of how deceived the nations currently are. You know, I mean, it's not like the nations are in enlightenment at this point as to who Yahweh is. There's total deception in the world today, maybe more so now than there ever has been. The Satan, the adversary, the Jew, has been let out of the pit. There's no doubt whatsoever.
Well, absolutely. They're ruling the world, and they have everybody deceived.
That has taken place, and it never ceases to amaze me the clarity of Ezekiel's prophecy concerning the end-time power of the Edomite Jew and how they are just able to amass an army, how they focus in on the destruction of Israel, our race. And, you know, as I'm sure we're going to get into tonight, you know, the whole area of where Israel, the mountains of Israel, it could only be where we are now, North America. And the power of the Gog and Magog in the end time just is an exact picture of the power of the Edomite Jew in the world today. They run the world. They control everything.
Well, absolutely.
And it's very profound, Ezekiel's prophecy, how exact it is, you know, and of course, like a lot of prophecies in the Bible, you know, it uses, you know, a lot of metaphorical language, a lot of language that, you know, seems somewhat archaic to us. But when we dissect it and figure it out and take a look at it, it paints a very clear picture to us of what is coming and what we can expect. And praise Yahweh. Yahweh is going to step in and slaughter Gog and Magog. We'll witness that if we're alive during that time. We'll be involved. So some absolutely fascinating, tremendous prophecy in these Ezekiel 38 and 39 chapters. Exciting chapters for true Israelites to read and understand. Glad we're getting into them tonight.
And when 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. That happened. It began with the Enlightenment, which was the philosophically allowed Satan to become the Edomite Jews to become scholars and academics in Europe. The Enlightenment paved the way for that, and the French Revolution assured its happening, and that was when the devil was completely out of his prison, right?
Right.
That's when the Edomite Jews gained full citizenship as peers with Christians in Europe, was during the French Revolution.
And I'm guessing, even though they've been working on this for many centuries, I'm guessing that's the time and the money at that point began to really flow for them, as it always was. But, you know, with the Rothschilds able to bankroll anything and everything at that point, I'm wondering if that was the time it really began to take form with them, this whole concept of absolutely stealing the identity of true Israel to the point where today it's a lie that's been told so often that it's just completely accepted as truth. You know, I mean, it's why we constantly have to, when we're speaking, remind people, oh, by the way, you know, we are Israel, not the Jews of today, the Ashkenazi Jew. I mean, their taking over of our identity has been so profoundly successful. I mean, you shake your head at how well they've done it. You know, even though history doesn't really teach it, if you look at the true, you know, archaeology and the true history, of course, they've revised it so much that it's hard to find the true history anymore.
Well, all you have to do is read old books. I mean, just read Josephus. Just read Paul. Just read... Yeah.
It exists. It just takes a little bit of effort. And, you know, academic effort has almost been bred out of our race at this point by them over the last 40, 50 years. You know, they've turned our race into academic sluggards. So... But yeah, praise Yahweh. We've been shown this, and it's very clear to us. So, I don't want to get ahead. I know we're coming into some of the main points of Yahweh's entire focus on why all of this is going on, so that His people, His race, will know that He is Yahweh. That's just tremendous. We'll get into that later tonight. I know. It's really
all right. But let me read verses 7 through 10 of Revelation 20, right? And when 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as of the sand of the sea. And they went up upon the breast of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. Brimstone. It's a punishment. It's eternal destruction. It's not a cleansing fire, as many fools suggest. Where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented night and day forever and ever. This is, if you read Revelation chapter 20, and you remove the part of verse 5 that does not belong there, you see basically a synopsis of the history of our race and a synopsis of the events that are also unfolded in Ezekiel 38 and 39. I'd like to recap that in part here. Ezekiel 38 verses 8 and 9 definitely prove this is an end time prophecy. Remember in Ezekiel 33, the people of Jerusalem, the last of the Israelites in Judea, were deported by the Babylonians, as Ezekiel explained. 38, 8, and 9 read, after many days thou shalt be visited. In the later years thou shalt come to the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people. Now, this is the only nation in history that was gathered out of many people in the sense of the fact that the Caucasian people, when they came into Europe, created many separate nations and languages in their migrations from Asia. And this land, this nation, is gathered out of those.
Right.
Against the mountains of Israel, which have always been waste, but are brought forth out of the nations. That only describes this land. And as I read, I think it was last week, I read Micah chapter 4, on the 10-10-10, in my first segment of the 10-10-10 presentation, I read Micah chapter 4 and demonstrated that America is the only land that fits the description of the land of Yahweh in Micah chapter 4. And Eli and I talked in great detail about that same thing here with Ezekiel chapter 38 last week. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm, talking to Gog and Magog. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. The Israel nations being flooded with aliens is also described in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 27 through 29, where Yahweh says that he will sow the house of Israel with the seed of man and the seed of beast, and that's a test for us And every man that eats the sour grapes, meaning the seed of the beast, shall die. That's very clear to me in Ezekiel 31:27-29. I'm sorry, Jeremiah 31:27-29. And if we read Jeremiah, that's right at the culmination of the new covenant, which is what we would expect to happen after Gog and Magog are destroyed, as Revelation chapter 21 describes, which is immediately after that prophecy of Gog and Magog in Revelation chapter 20, right?
Right.
They're all talking about the same subject from different perspectives. Ezekiel 38:10, thus says Yahweh God, it shall come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought, and thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages, I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates. This can only describe North America. At one time, every city in Europe was walled. Every city in Palestine and the Middle East had been walled. That it's only North America that was founded with and has forever had unwalled cities.
Right, and it just shows that they're flooding us with all these other races. All of a sudden, we're not so unwalled anymore, and it's hard for us to dwell safely, you know, and it's hard for us to dwell without walls. And now we need bars and gates because we've been flooded with criminal alien races that in every city in the United States now, crime is rampant. So, you know, the Jew, through their Immigration Act and their satanic strategy, has flooded us with criminals. You know, flooded us to bring chaos, to bring misery, to bring the race mixing among us with the other races. Such a devilish strategy that's been very successful for them, to destroy us. You know, to weaken us, to destroy us, just to bring about chaos in this great nation. So, a great judgment is coming on them for that. But in the meantime, we live in the midst of it now. It's going on all around us. So it's good to have these clear thoughts that we're talking and seeing that this is all part of Yahweh's plan. You know, Yahweh allowed them to do this for a lesson to us, to, you know, for our own judgment. His face is hidden from us, although he's beginning to show his face to us now, which is excellent for us. You're right, Bill. He can only be describing this country right here. There's just too many pointers to make this anywhere else in the world other than North America, the United States. So, anyway.
Well, no doubt.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this explains to me, this is the only explanation for why all these immigrants have been allowed to overrun the white race. And white people see these aliens who have flooded into our nations as immigrants and as future Americans and as hard workers, and they're going to work hard and help build our nation because we can't have babies because we'd rather be sleeping with other guys, right? And that's basically what's going on. That's the attitude in this country. It's crazy. Well, these people don't see themselves as immigrants, and they'll never really see themselves as Americans. They only call themselves Americans when it comes time to collect benefits. They see themselves as conquerors and invaders. That's exactly how they see themselves.
They don't want to assimilate, even given the opportunity. They don't want to become American. I mean, they might become an American citizen because that's the way for them to cash in. But inwardly, they most of them never assimilate. You know?
Well, right, and it's white man, get out of the way. As soon as they have sufficient numbers, that they'll do everything they can to get rid of us. There's no doubt. And they aren't going to work while we all collect Social Security because we haven't had enough children to support us in our old age. It's not going – if you think that a generation of Mexicans is going to support a generation of old white people, that's just crazy. There's no way they're going to do that.
That thought never occurred to me, because I know that isn't going to happen. You know, I'm amazed our Social Security system is, of course, you know, they're just printing money now at this point, so that's the only reason that there is any Social Security at all. You know, I'm sure they don't have a nickel put away for any future payments. So, but yeah, you're right. These aliens that are flooding in here and that have flooded in here are, in a sense, they will become a willing army to, you know, to turn against us probably with little provocation.
Well, that's why this Ezekiel 38 and 39 may not necessitate a military invasion. I'm not going to rule that out 100%, and we'll talk about that as we get to Ezekiel 39.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I did read through Clifton's message, and I saw his, you know, proposed a scenario of, you know, the foreign troops and the railway cars, and, you know, who knows? He may have it right, but there's millions of people among us that are already here that would turn against us, meaning true Israel.
In a minute, the first chance they
got.
In a minute
they would. In a minute. And
our cities are loaded with Mexicans and Chinamen. Our posts are loaded with them. Arabs and Indians and Pakistanis. All these, they're Gog and Magog. There's no doubt with the Jews.
Yeah.
Who, I believe Gog actually describes the Jews, and I'll describe that, the Edomite Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews, and I'll describe that a little later. Right.
Okay.
Now I'd like to read from 38:12, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations. So these aliens have flooded into our land to take us as a spoil and a prey. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, which to me describes the Arab and Mediterranean peoples, and Dedan was an Edomite city, with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey? To carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil. Well, of course they're going to come here to take a spoil. That's what they've been doing. $60 billion a year gets sent back to Mexico by the Mexicans that are here. We never see that money again. The Jews in Mexico just rake it right in. That the that basically these people work here and don't spend here, don't really contribute to our economy, and send the money home. The Chinese do the same thing. They spend, that they steal billions of dollars here, and they send it back to China.
Right.
It's been going on for 30 years.
Or the large numbers that don't work at all, that we insanely allow in by the millions that just come over here and get on all kinds of public free money assistance, welfare, Medicaid, on and on and on, that, you know, are living so much better than they ever lived where they came from. What's their motivation to ever even work? They're just taking their spoil on a monthly check, of course, that we're paying for.
Well, exactly. And it's time that our people recognize the die in diversity, right?
Yeah. Oh, it'll be our demise if Yahweh doesn't intervene, no question.
Okay. Ezekiel 38:14. Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say unto Gog, thus says Yahweh God, in that day when my people of Israel dwell safely, shalt thou not know it, and thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts. Let me say that I believe they are the north parts relative to Ezekiel, and that's from where the Ashkenazi Jews came, and we'll see this later. While the Ashkenazi are not our only trouble, they are certainly at the vanguard of the entire social upheaval that have brought these conditions on that we are in today. And we swallowed it, or at least enough of us did, so that they could get away with it. Come from thy place out of the north parts thou, and many people with thee. And that's exactly what's happened. All of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army, and thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. And I think the horses and the army are just, they could very well just be symbolic. I don't think that necessitates that we are invaded by a foreign army. We've already been invaded by millions
right.
of foreigners, and we've invited it. And thou shalt come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the later days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen or that the nations may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O God, before their eyes. Yahweh is going to be sanctified by the destruction of these aliens.
Exactly.
And of
That's
God. Exactly. We do not have the details here as to how this happens, but we find that the description related above, where chapter 20, verse 9 of the Revelation is cited, that you know, the lake of fire and brimstone, and it seems to be like a cataclysmic event or a tumultuous time of war, and that's the way the description seems to be. Verse 17, thus says Yahweh God, art he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them, meaning I would bring Gog against Israel. And first let me say, all of our wars and revolutions have been instigated for hundreds of years by the satanic Edomite Jew. And now that through those wars and revolutions, the Jew has come to rule over us, we are being flooded with aliens so that he may try to destroy us. The one place I find that this is prophesied, as Ezekiel wrote here, is Isaiah. And in Isaiah chapter 27, verses 1 through 4, where it says, in that day Yahweh with his soaring great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. To me, that means the Edomite Jewish people among the sea of peoples, of other peoples. In that day sing ye unto her a vineyard of red wine. I, Yahweh, do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them. I would burn them together. This is a reference to the Jews and those Arab races descended from Cain. They are the Leviathan. They are the descendants of the serpent. It is also a reference to that same harvest found in Revelations 14, verses 14 through 20, the harvests of the parched grapes and the ripe grapes. I had pointed that out and read it last week. I don't plan on reading it again this week. You might have some comment on it.
No, not too much. Just I like your interpretation of the Leviathan, the piercing serpent. You know, in our mind, we think some, you know, sea monster kind of thing, but obviously, you know, it's not that. So
they are the serpent, and the sea is a sea of people, and they
right.
are the serpent hidden and operating within that sea of people. This is, I don't think it's talking about a whale or a crocodile.
Right. It's just clear metaphorical language that, with understanding of who Gog and Magog is in these various contexts, it becomes pretty clear that a lot of this is pointing to the Jew, you know, the Edomite Jew in the end time that will rule the world. And they're just he's just being described by various means. So, and Yahweh's using various means to make it clear that he's going to be the one to slay these Edomite Jews in the end. So,
well, absolutely, and we'll discuss that a little at the very last paragraph of Revelation 38.
You know, I do want to make one comment. In my studies in the books of Enoch, one thing has become clear. Israel doesn't really get it together so much on her own. You know, we don't rise up and cast out the Jew in the end. We don't rise up and slay and have a great victory over the Edomites on our own. It just doesn't happen.
Well, you know, it can't happen. Yahweh tells us over and over again, vengeance is his, and he will do it. Now, a lot of people believe that we could be a part of that. It might be that some of us are, however, I doubt it. Because if we destroyed our enemies and cleansed our nation, how could we, as a people, give credit to God?
Right, exactly.
Our history has told us time and again, that whenever we've been victorious, we have forgotten God. So what makes us think
that's probably most of our personal testimonies in times of success or when we do well financially. You know, it doesn't exactly draw us near to Yahweh. Most of the time it pushes us the other way because we're doing okay on our own.
And we're told over and over again that his enemies will be destroyed for his glory, not for ours.
Right, and there's some really excellent verses in Enoch. I don't have them in front of me, but, I mean, essentially they just say that Yahweh, I'm paraphrasing, but that he got tired of Israel not being able to accomplish his victory, and he did it himself for his own glory and for his own righteousness. He steps in and brings about the end of the age and slays the Edomite Jews. So all of these books just follow that exact same kind of a thought, that at the end, Yahweh steps in and intervenes and brings judgment for the benefit of Israel.
Well, right. That's exactly what Ezekiel 38 is about to say.
Yeah, just a tremendous consistency across the revelation that it's Yahweh at the end that steps in. Apparently, we just, not that we have nothing to do with it, but we essentially have very little part in it at the end. In fact, if Yahweh didn't step in, we'd probably be slaughtered. You know, we'd be finished apart from his intervention.
Well, what we're told when we're going to intervene, we're told it's going to take us 7 months to bury the bodies, right?
Right.
Verse 18, and it shall come to pass at the same time when God shall come against the land of Israel, saith Yahweh God, that my fury shall come up in my face. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there should be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of heaven and the beasts of the field and all the creeping things that creep upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And
right.
I believe this has its parallels in Revelation 12:16, where it says, and the earth assisted the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and gulped down the river which the dragon had cast from his mouth.
Yes.
And in Revelation 20, verse 9, and they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Verse 21, and I will call for the sword against them.
It's the two same events, the great
shaking.
Well,
I believe that they're the same events, yes, and
okay.
I elucidated that last week, and they are both basically an overview of the history of our race. And the times and half the time that the woman had run to the wilderness and they fed her for a time, times and half a time. Well, that is our race receiving the gospel. And it took that long for most of our race to get the gospel and convert to Christianity.
All right.
So that was the period that the woman was fed, was the period that the woman was fed with the gospel. Okay? And the river from the dragon's mouth were all the other races during that time that had tried to invade and destroy us. We had the Moors, we had the Mongols, the Turks, all trying to get into Europe during that period.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes, yeah, certainly the flood out of the dragon's mouth of these other races, no doubt about that.
Well, definitely. Verse 21, and I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith Yahweh God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. Well, to me, that describes the period since then that we've only engaged in war against ourselves. The 30 Years' War, the First World War, the Second World War, the Napoleonic Wars, the Prussian Wars, that to me, the American, the War of Northern Aggression, I should call it, right? The war between the states. This,
I mean,
to me, this describes
ahead.
That time.
Yeah,
to me, that's
that phrase describes pretty much every war that we've been involved in for, you know, the last couple hundred years. It essentially, it's been against each other, against our own race, slaughtering
ourselves. Well, absolutely. And I think that's what Ezekiel 38 is explaining, that first the period that we were threatened by the rivers of armies from Satan passed, and then we just started fighting each other. And
right.
now we're flooded with the aliens. But they walked in here, more or less we let them. We volunteered to have them here, right? Verse
at least we were volunteered, you know. Of course, most of our people at this point are so racially naive that, you know,
well,
they'll
right.
line up to help these people.
I talk about our leaders. I talk about our politicians, that they volunteered us, basically.
Yes.
And most of those politicians that did that were actually white. I mean, Teddy Kennedy is not a Jew. For as much as we'd like to make him a Jew, the man is not a Jew. And he authored the Immigration Act of 1965.
Yeah, but there was Jews involved in that, certainly.
Well, right, but I mean, the Irish and the English and the Germans went right along with them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure there was Jews pulling the strings, though. What was that known as the Hart Celler Act, I believe, right? 1965. Yeah, Jews were authoring that as well. But, yeah, Kennedy was on board, sadly.
Verse 22. And I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood, and I will rain upon him and upon his bands and upon the many people that are with him in overflowing rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. This, to me, indicates the destruction of our enemies by forces other than ourselves. Now here's, I have a rhetorical question. If we did it ourselves, if we effected our own liberation from the beast, if we destroyed the enemies of God by our own hands, could we by any means acknowledge the hand of Yahweh in our salvation? History gives us a resounding no. So therefore, Yahweh must be our Savior, as he says he is.
Yeah, Bill. I that's kind of what we've been talking about. At the end, it will be all Yahweh. Yahweh's destruction of the enemy, I believe, will be so just outwardly dramatic and profoundly powerful. I mean, he mentions up in the earlier verses about the shaking. I mean, we could talk about that for a long time, the shaking that's going to go on. There's going to be no doubt in people's mind that some amazingly divine thing is happening right in front of them. And obviously the result of that is that they are going to know who Yahweh is. And he says that's the reason that he's doing it.
Well, right. That has to be unequivocal.
Unequivocal. And it will be. There will be no doubt. So, you know, when I read these kind of verses, it makes me profoundly thankful that I know who Yahweh is right now, that I don't have to see. I mean, I'm not saying I see a lot, but I know who Yahweh is. I know his name. I praise his name on a daily basis. But the vast majority of our people, our race, do not see these things that we see. They don't even know the name of Yahweh. So, you know, there's going to be a massive awakening here one of these days. But I just am very thankful to be in that early group of people that Yahweh has awakened, that know who he is tonight. So I just want to say praise Yahweh that there are some of us that Yahweh has awakened early. And that's a tremendous privilege. And also, I view it as a lot of responsibility for all of us that are in Christian identity now. You know, eventually all the whites are going to be in Christian identity when this happens. You know, the ones that escape judgment, the ones that haven't race mixed. But for now, Yahweh has selected a select group that I believe is a tremendous privilege to be part of, his early remnant, his early awakened ones. So I do not take lightly the fact that Yahweh has shown me or any of us, awakened us early before this event has taken place. I don't believe that it's by accident, and tremendous responsibility is on every one of us that names the name of Yahweh. So I wanted to add that. So praise Yahweh that we're the early ones that have seen who he is, that he's reached out and opened our eyes.
I would like to, before starting Ezekiel chapter 39, I'd like to say something. I believe, you know, a lot of people, I try to explain to them that, or other Israel identity writers try to explain to them that Genesis 1:1 through 2:4 is the creation of Adam and the entire planet or universe or however you want to look at it. In addition, you know, in one summary, and from Genesis 2:4 through the end of chapter 4, it's the story of the creation of Adam, the same Adam from a, and his race from a different perspective, right? And,
right.
And that's what I believe. And that's, you know, there's only one Adam. There's a first Adam, and that was Adam, and there was a second Adam, and that was Christ. There weren't a six-day in creation, eighth-day creation of Adam. That's ridiculous. And people would scoff at me that the Bible doesn't explain the same thing twice in a row. Well, here we have Ezekiel 38 and 39. At the end of Ezekiel 38, Yahweh says that all of his enemies are destroyed, and with fire and brimstone. And then at the beginning of Ezekiel 39, we see another explanation of the same thing. It's the same literary method that was used in Genesis. And a lot of people would scoff at that, but here it's perfectly clear.
Yeah, you know, it's like a large newspaper headline. Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and then the next 10 pages go into all the details of what happened. It's not a whole new narrative. It's more detail on the previous narrative. So I think that's what you're trying to say. I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying. You know, the Bible will repeat different gives different points of view, more detail, back up, and it's not necessarily always written in perfect chronological order like we like
right.
to work on it.
Exactly. And
that's our shallow viewpoint.
Here we have an example of that, and that's all I'm trying to point out. Do you want to read Ezekiel 39:1?
Yeah. Do you want me to read off of your notes here, or I've got a...
Well, I mean, you could read it from wherever you want, right? But my notes are where I'm going to make comments, basically.
All right, I'll read it, and you jump in with comments. Let me just get over to it real quick. Ezekiel 39 here. All right. I'm reading from the Sacred Name King James Version. Therefore, thou son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come up from the north parts, and will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel.
Now, I believe this is explaining our relationship with the other races today, right? That there's no more Moors that threaten us. There's no more Golden Horde, no more Tamerlane, Santa Ana, Geronimo. The Turks don't have Vienna under siege anymore. And all of those aliens that have tried to defeat us face on have been turned back. But now they immigrate legally and they walk amongst us freely. It's like we let the invaders in as our friends. And while we see them as immigrants, they still see themselves as conquerors, and we have volunteered to be their plunder.
Well, it just give you more insight on how immigration has completely been controlled and taken over by Jews. I mean, it's such a smart strategy, and even though it's taken decades to get it to this point, their patience, their cross-generational patience has been demonstrated many times. You know, they're not in a hurry necessarily to destroy us. I mean, look how they've taken the last 100 years from, say, 1913 with the Federal Reserve and the income tax and the ADL all in 1 year. That's almost 100 years has passed since that. And look how far they've come in 100 years to bring destruction upon us. And it's like they're just setting up the chessboard for the checkmate move. You know, very, very patient. It's like if a ton of them die in the middle of it, it's no big deal. More Jews are being raised up that'll carry on the plan. Surely they have a plan. And, you know, I think you're right again that we've allowed the enemy now. You know, pretty much no one is going to attack us head on with our power. But if we flood ourselves with the enemy, then we could be taken by them a little bit at a time. One Mexican at a time, one Asian at a time, one Negro at a time. It's like they're their soldiers, the Jewish soldiers. You know, they're just waiting to be, they're waiting for the right motivation to attack.
Well, that's what they do. They throw 10 niggers into a suburb and hope to take out 5 white women.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they do.
And they do, you know. So, yeah, every time you read any newspaper or check any news story in any kind of major city, It's usually 5, 6, 8 stories of, you know, some dark-skinned person attacking, raping, killing, carjacking some white-skinned person.
Okay. No,
they kill each other too, but when they want something, they come and kill one of us because we're the ones with possessions. So, a very effective devilish strategy, no doubt about it. Let's see. Did you want to say more, or do you want me to read on starting at 3?
Verse 3.
And I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. Thou shalt fall upon the open field, for I have spoken it, saith the Adonai Yahweh. And I will send a fire on Magog, and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles, and they shall know that I am Yahweh.
And this, you know, Revelation chapter 19, verses 19 to 21. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered to make war with him sitting upon the horse and with his army. And he seized the beast and with him the false prophet who had been making signs before him by which he deceived those having received the inscribed mark of the beast and who worshipped his image. These two are cast alive into the lake of fire burning with sulfur. And those remaining were slain by the sword of him sitting upon the horse which came out from his mouth. And all the birds ate their fill from their flesh. This is describing the marriage supper of the Lamb. The day that the enemies of God are destroyed, that is the marriage supper of the Lamb. It's the celebration before the actual marriage.
That makes
verse
a lot
6.
Of sense, Bill. Go ahead.
Well, that's the entire context of Revelation chapter 19. Verse 6, where it says, I will send a fire on Magog and destroy them that dwell carelessly in the isles, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. That's exactly parallel to Revelation 20, verse 9. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city, and the fire of God came out of heaven and devoured them. And that's how Ezekiel chapter 38 also ended.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense that this event would, you know, be part of the tremendous celebration of us, of the wedding feast with Yahshua. You know, this would be quite an event. And again, I keep thinking back to so much of the verses in Enoch book 1 that talk about Yahweh's people. Will be witnesses to the final judgment on the enemies of Yahweh and the fulfillment of Revelation 2:9 and 3:9, where we will witness these Edomites trying to repent at the end to Yahweh, and we will witness the exact fulfillment where Yahweh says, and they shall know that I have loved you, meaning true Israel, us, and Enoch details that out. And these people at the end actually try to repent and say, you know, now we know who you are. We know you're Yahweh. You know, they try to beg forgiveness, and Yahweh has none of it and sends them off to eternal judgment. It's a very profound picture. So, again, these books are just, you know, giving us a different view of all of that. So it all fits. It never ceases to amaze me how all the scriptures fit so well together. Even if they don't seem to fit sometimes, if you study and look, they fit. They are describing this event at the end, the destruction of the enemies of Yahweh and true Israel.
Well, absolutely. Would you like to read from verse 7?
Verse 7 here. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel. I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore. And the heathen shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel.
Now basically, look at the world. His people don't even know there's a problem.
Right.
But most of his people, most of the people of our race don't even know there's a problem. Yet he is going to make his name known and cleanse the land of the aliens and the bastards and everything else that offends.
This is a profound verse here.
If his people don't even know there's a problem, how the hell could they do it themselves? How could they do anything for themselves? Most of them are hopeless. They're sitting at home with beer on their couch, worshiping niggers on television.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. You know, playing fantasy football league. But, I mean, let me read this verse again. There's so much in this verse. All of this is for this purpose right here. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore. And the heathens, probably, and the nations shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel. This is a glorious verse here. I mean, Yahweh, you can just sense Yahweh yearning that his people will know his name, who he is, and all that involves. And when I see verses like this, it just completely confirms to me the truth of Christian identity. Because to me, one of the foundational beliefs in identity is knowing the name of Yahweh. I still remember the very first time I began to touch Christian identity, how excited I was that for the first time I actually knew the name of God, his real name. You know,
well, once we understand the name that we use for him and its meaning, he becomes a living entity and not a nondescript, ambiguous God, right?
Exactly. You know, he's not...
It awakens your mind to other facets of his being.
What did you say?
It awakens your mind to other facets of his being.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Because now you have the foundational belief and knowledge of who he really is. I mean, it would be like you being married to somebody, and you didn't really know who their name was. All you knew were their titles. Wife, spouse, helpmeet. You don't really get to know anybody until you know their name. The name is a critical aspect of Yahweh. Obviously it is, because he emphasizes it thousands of times in the scripture. You know, it's absolutely vital to know his name. His name is Yahweh. And again, it amazes me that he's called out a number of us early before the giant event takes place and unveiled himself to us. That is not by accident. And it's a very, very important matter. So, I don't know. I just praise Yahweh that his holy name will be known in the midst of his people. I mean, that is seemingly the point of him doing all of this. His people will know his name. And apparently, there much polluting of his holy name is going on now, and that's a given. I mean, that pretty much sums up the Judeo-Christianity concept, is polluting the name of Yahweh on a very regular basis. By not even calling him Yahweh, knowing his name of Yahweh, that alone is polluting his name.
Well, the Jews forbid them to say it, right?
Yeah.
You can't say that name. Yet only the high priest can whisper that name once a year in the temple. And there is no more temple, so nobody could say the name.
Well, I'm a good example. I went through, you know, a four-year Bible college degree program and got a college degree with a Bible major. I never heard the name of Yahweh one time. Not even in the sense of, well, this is what the ancient Jews used to call God. His name was Yahweh, but, you know, that was a Jewish thing, and we don't do that. Never even that much. That name was completely hidden in all the Christianity that I was involved in.
Well, it was hidden in plain sight because the Romans called him Jove, right?
Yeah.
It's the same word. Etymologically, it's the same exact word.
But I'm saying even in Christianity, apart from, say, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't even, you know, use an actual name of God. It's strictly titles.
No, if you use his name, you might offend people, because then the Muslims can't have their Allah, and the Hindus can't have their Shiva, and the Chinese can't have whatever the hell it is that they have for a God, and the Jews can't have their money.
Just think about it, even for a second, how different life would be if the entire white race knew who Yahweh was and knew who they were.
Well, if they would only If they would only obey the Ten Commandments, it would be a totally different world, right? I mean, let's just get that far.
Yeah, that would be an outstanding start. So, but apparently this is what it's going to take to wake the white race up. A massive world, you know, giant shaking of the earth, slaughtering of countless hordes of enemies. I mean, is this what it will take to wake up the white race?
Well, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take something drastic because that these people are too busy worshiping God's enemies and enjoying it, and they love it.
But, I mean, when you see what it's going to take to wake up the white race as a whole, doesn't it not give you a tremendous thankful heart that we are awake now, tonight? I mean, that it won't take, you know, it won't take the end of the world, so to speak, for us to wake up. We have been
right, but it also comes with responsibility, right?
Huge, yeah, big time.
Because you have to wake your brother up, or at least try. And that's the way it is.
And I think most of us accept that responsibility, because finally we see the true religion. We see Yahweh. I mean, I've been a Christian for a lot of years. Of course, you know, you could argue you were one from birth if you were born a white man. But when I see the truth in identity, I realize this is the truth, the highest truth that does exist in this world. This truth unlocks all the holy scriptures and makes it all make sense. And it makes, you know, they all come clear now when you see who is Israel, who is Yahweh, what the future is of true Israel, our race. The whole Bible opens up. That makes it not so much easy to accept the responsibility, but it makes it you clear there is no other choice, and you want to accept it. I honestly had a lot of struggles as a minister. I thought, you know, I really need to be doing certain things, but I didn't have that inner excitement or burning sense that I really wanted to.
Do you get excited over Judeo-Christianity?
Yeah.
You can't get excited over that garbage.
Well, outwardly.
Ooh, maybe it'll happen tomorrow will be the rapture. I'm excited, aren't you? It might happen tomorrow.
I can't tell you how introspective I was for so long in it, going, what is my problem? Why don't I fit in here, you know? Why can't I be like somebody like a Joel Osteen, you know, some excited guy? I don't know. But
well, because you don't want that plane and that Rolls Royce badly enough, I guess.
Well, now I know, looking back, Yahweh was going to call me out and unveil who he was to me. You know, he was going to bring me into Christian identity and show me truth.
Well, the day is coming when Joel Osteen has a serious problem, right?
Oh, yeah, no doubt whatsoever. Yeah, that's a given, yes. No doubt about it, you know. Although I still marvel. I watch him once in a while just for a few minutes out of a morbid curiosity. And I'm always amazed to see 15 or 20,000 people in there. Of course, you know, half of them are blacks and Mexicans and Asians. And, I mean, it's a real multicultural crockpot beef stew kind of filling the pews in there. So, of course, you know, what does he care? He's a head counter.
Well, right. And he's worried about unclean beasts, and he has an audience full of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Would you like to read from verse 8, maybe?
Yep. Behold, it is come, and it is done, saith the Adonai Yahweh. This is the day whereof I have spoken. Praise Yahweh. What a great verse. And they that dwell in the cities of Israel shall go forth and shall set on fire and burn the weapons, both the shields and the bucklers, the bows and the arrows and the hand staves and the spears. And they shall burn them with fire 7 years. So that they shall take no wood out of the field, neither cut down any out of the forests, for they shall burn the weapons with fire, and they shall spoil those that spoiled them, and rob those that robbed them, saith the Adonai Yahweh. You know, Bill, this seems to kind of add some weight to what you were thinking it might have been, as not so much an outside attack, but an attack from within.
Well, right, and I believe that's what it is. But here I'd like to mention Clifton Emma Heise's paper, right? Okay, and it's available. It's available on his website. It's under it's at emmaheiser.christogenia.org. It's called The Problems with Ezekiel 38 and 39 and the Prophetic Attack of Russia on the United States. Now, first I would like to say that Bertrand Comparé and Wesley Swift really believed that Ezekiel 38 and 39 would culminate with the Cold War and an attack by the Soviets on America. And surely so did Clifton at one time. And Clifton may still now. Anyway, if I were a commentator on prophecy and scripture at the time of Bertrand Comparé and Wesley Swift, I have to say that I would have thought so too. And as Eli and I discussed last week, the Gog and Magog prophecy surely seems to point in that direction. And if you'd have seen the Cold War and Soviet Russia and the constant, it was played up by the media, right? But
right.
You heard about the constant tension between the Soviet Union and the United States. You would think, you would really read Ezekiel 38 and 39, and with the knowledge we have of the people that it's talking about, you would believe that Russia was going to do it, they were going to attack us, and that was the fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 and 39. And I don't, I don't see how anybody wouldn't have seen it that way. But now we know today that it wasn't that way, right?
Right.
In Clifton's paper, Clifton explains how a pastor, W.M.H. Milner, in 1883, first noticed the connections between Gog and Magog and Russia. And I would like to add that this connection may still be validly observed to this day. And Eli and I spoke about that at great length last week. And Clifton quotes Milner as explaining that the meaning of Gog indicates something great or large, as in gigantic. Now, most Christian Israel commentators accept that. And I must say, however, as I did last week, that the Hebrew word Agag, which seems to be related to Gog, and the root of the word God, the derivation, really means top or chief and not large or gigantic. Milner then connects Magog, a Japhethite tribe, to Mongolia. And he is quoting from an even older book on that topic entitled Russian Japheth. And all of this is quite plausible. None of it can really be scoffed at. And the connections indeed seem to be historic. And long before even the children of Israel, as the Scythians, sojourned in the Altai and the Ural Mountains and in the Russian steppe for quite some time before they moved west into Europe, many sub-tribes of the Japhethites and other Shemitic tribes preceded them into those regions. And as one example, L.A. Waddell was a 1920s anthropologist, and he established with certainty that long ago there was indeed an Aryan culture in Tibet at a very early time. That was, and that culture couldn't have been related to the Scythian Israelites because it preceded the Assyrian deportations. And it could be shown that other Aryans were up in that region for a long time before the Israelites were over there. Now, I can't possibly describe all of Clifton's paper here. And I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs from it after we read Ezekiel 39, verses 11 through 16. But for now, I'll just say that although Milner, and through Milner and Comparé and others, Clifton shows how Ezekiel 38 and Ezekiel 39 describe an alliance of Russia, along with all of the nations of the Arab world, against America. Now, even though I don't believe this is wholly correct, I do personally think that it is very close, and I'll discuss my own opinion a bit later. But I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs from Clifton's paper, but not until we read verses 11 through 16 here.
All right. Do you want me to keep reading, or are you going to read?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm at verse 11. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will give unto Gog a place there of graves in Israel, the valley of the passengers on the east of the sea, and it shall stop the noses of the passengers. And there shall they bury Gog and all his multitude, and they shall call it the Valley of Hamon Gog. And 7 months shall the house of Israel be bearing of them, that they may cleanse the land. Yea, all the people of the land shall bury them, and it shall be to them a renown the day that I shall be glorified, saith the Adonai Yahweh. And they shall sever out men of continual employment, passing through the land to bury with the passengers those that remain upon the face of the earth, to cleanse it. After the end of 7 months shall they search. And the passengers that pass through the land, when anyone seeth a man's bone, then shall he set up a sign by it till the buriers have buried it in the Valley of Hamon Gog. And also the name of the city shall be Hamanah. Thus shall they cleanse the land.
Now, Clifton, in his paper on Ezekiel 38 and 39, lays out a very plausible scenario that this prophecy foresees not only the tens of millions of immigrants that have already flooded into our countries, but also a military invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I said above, he gives a lengthy background identifying the parties involved, and then he lays out one plausible scenario for its fulfillment. And part of this scenario is the attempt to identify the valley of passengers from the description which Ezekiel relates, as you just read, right?
Right.
Of course, the location does seem to fit Clifton's conclusion very well, that it describes the Flaming Gorge area of southwestern Wyoming. And there is evidence that this valley of passengers, which is east of the Salt Sea, which is the Salt Lake of Utah, could very well be describing this area. If we take it, we find it necessary to take the description literally. Now, the hypothesis is very attractive, since it does seem to fit that description very well. And I wouldn't scoff at it. The area is near the point of rendezvous where the first transcontinental railroad was built, and hence it's called the place of rendezvous, right? And here I would like to read two paragraphs from from Clifton's nearly 40-page paper on the subject, which is available on his website. A scenario of how, and this is Clifton's subtitle, right? A scenario of how Ezekiel 38 and 39 may happen. And now I'm quoting Clifton's words. At the time of this writing, and then in parentheses he says, my first writing, this issue is my second. He had revised this paper. The Oklahoma bombing took place a little over 2 months ago. Today is June 30th, 1995. The bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, took place April 19th, 1995. Apparently, the bombing was designed to set up a condition in the United States to increase the federal police powers for the creation of a totalitarian police state. I will not get into that to any extent, except to say that maybe this time the government, and the powers behind it, isn't fooling very many people with this one. It appears like maybe this time the whole thing may be backfiring on the perpetrators. What we wished, right? But we shouldn't sell the enemy short on this one. I believe that the enemy, out of desperation, may well decide if they cannot create a police state from the inside, they will try to do so from the outside. And I must interject that this is still very plausible. As a matter of fact, if the people of the United States wake up about this one, the enemy, the Jews being themselves part of Gog and Magog, may have to move out of desperation or have their whole plan for world domination blow up in their faces. Even at this point, the state of Oklahoma is going to initiate its own independent investigation of the bombing and will probably pressure the feds, the FBI and the ATF, to come clean on this one. We could have only wished. This may be just the thing that will cause them, Gog and Magog, to think the evil thought of Ezekiel 38:10. In other words, they may direct Gog, Magog, Meshech, and Tubal, whom they already control, to invade the United States and overthrow the police powers that exist and set up their own United Nations police to control the United States. Naturally, they would promise the communist hordes all the booty and plunder, rape and whatever they wanted. They would be promised all that they could steal. The scripture, in no uncertain terms, indicates that Gog is coming for spoil. It is now March 7th, 2000, when Clifton rewrote this paper. He revised it. And I still believe our satanic enemy will be right there to open our back door for them. Although I am not certain what the hooks in the jaws might be. Since my first writing, I have learned the Chinese now own our major railways, along with an agreement to control the Panama Canal. Not only this, they now own shipyards on our west coast. To continue quoting Clifton, now this is how I propose it all might happen. First of all, we have to take into account the gigantic size of such an operation, and Clifton kind of makes a play on words in his spelling with the word God, right? I don't believe offhand that this could be a total parachute from the air attack, like a cloud to cover the land he's referring to, although this may be part of the operation. This attack is going to take many large shiploads of men and equipment. At this writing, my first, there is documented proof that many trainloads of equipment have already been shipped into the United States and are in storage awaiting the men to operate them. This will be no small operation. I believe also that it will take the form of a sneak attack, and we will not know about it until they were already here. If this is true, there is only one way that it could happen. I suggest that 50 to 100 merchant ships, and if the men are going to number in the millions, it will be a lot more than this, will enter the United States at Seattle, San Francisco, or maybe even Long Beach, California. Do you suppose that this may be why they are closing down some of the naval bases, meaning on the West Coast, in preparation for such a move? I suggest further then they will offload these men and equipment and transfer them to sealed boxcars and make up several trains in excess of 100 cars, and they will make their way to Flaming Gorge in Wyoming. They could transfer the men and equipment already enclosed in container cars. How many trains would it take to be equal to maybe 50 or 100 ships and probably much more? It is interesting to note that these would be the logical routes for these trains to take in order to make their way eastward. By the time they would arrive in the area of Flaming Gorge in Wyoming, they would be train after train for maybe up to 50 miles or more on both sides of the tracks. There might be several trains diverted, There might be several trains diverted to sidetracks in that area as they climb to higher and higher altitudes. Then you can see how timely an earthquake would be to block them from going forward or backward. They would be trapped in the pass of, quote unquote, crossover on the mountains of Israel. And Clifton makes a good case for this area. This being described, the area described by Ezekiel in this chapter. Just how Yahweh handles it from here is anyone's guess, but there are none to survive. At this point, being blocked from both directions, they would try to take to the roads and the highways, and this would be like a cloud to cover the land. If this is all true, it would be the biggest Trojan horse operation ever pulled almost off. Ever almost pulled off, perhaps. There is one other thing. Once the enemy has put foot on our soil, it will be impossible for us to use atomic weapons against him. I would say the government wouldn't want to do that anyway, because the government would probably want the enemy on our soil. So it will be impossible for us to use atomic weapons against him, as we would be destroying our own people. We might reciprocate by using them against their homelands, though, but will they find some of our people to use as hostages to prevent it? This type of attack is the only way the enemy could come to our shores totally undetected. This way they could evade all satellites and radar, and it is still the only way they could move that large amount of equipment as described in the scripture. And I would still have to say that this is a plausible scenario, but I don't think it's entirely necessitated by this scripture.
Right. Well, now, go ahead.
I have some notes here. And as for myself, I think Clifton's paper is good, and it may be indicative of what is to come, but I do not totally agree with it. In fact, I am certain that even Clifton's position might be different in some degree today, but it is nevertheless a good and thought-provoking paper and worthy of a read. My own opinion is that Gog, related to the word Agag, means top or chief and not really huge. So it relates to the princes of this world. And once we identify them, we find that they did come out of Russia and that the latest Russian government is nothing but a front for them. They still run Russia today. They also run China, the U.S., and most of Europe. So God really is the top or the chief. The Ashkenazi Jew has taken over all of the West and therefore is the top and the chief. And the Ashkenazi Jew himself being a genetic blend of Edomite, Aryan, and Turk, along with several other races mixed in, is now purposely flooding the West with the Arab peoples and has been doing so for the past 40 years. The Ashkenazi Jew has engineered this plot against our race, which has taken centuries to unfold. The Edomite Jews invented Islam, and they have used it to control both the Turks and the Arabs ever since. This, I believe, is the invasion of Gog from the land of Magog. We have already been living in it. However, that does not mean that the Jews won't bring Russian and or Chinese armies into our land in addition to the immigration invasion. However, the Christian must know that when all these things come to their fullest, Yahweh our God will destroy our enemies before our eyes. We only need to keep his commandments.
Right. That's great. You know, the army is essentially already here, and it's being added to every day. You know, we really get very few numbers on how much actual immigration is going on. I mean, they tell us, but who knows what the real numbers are. All I know is any time I go out anymore, I just see hordes of people that are not white everywhere I go. So, there's they have a lot of people already here.
The invaders are all around us. We're already surrounded, is right.
Millions of them. So, you know, and they're, and let's face it, God controls them. Gog, not G-O-D, Gog, the Jew, because the Jew feeds most of them. And whoever feeds you controls you. You know, whoever pays for your house, pays for your food, gives you medical care, you know, they have control over these people. That's for sure.
Well, there's no doubt. Would you like to read from verse 17?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Yeah, we left off. All right, starting at 17. And thou son of man, thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, speak unto every feathered fowl and to every beast of the field. Assemble yourselves and come. Gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you. Even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. You shall eat the flesh of the mighty and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, and of goats, of bullocks, all of them fatlings of Bashan. And you shall eat fat till you be full and drink blood till you be drunken. Of my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you, thus shall you be filled at my table with horses and chariots, with mighty men and with all men of war, saith the Adonai Yahweh. And I will set my glory among the heathen, and all the heathen shall see my judgment that I have executed and my hand that I have laid upon them. So the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh their Elohim from that day and forward. And the heathen shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them.
And this can't possibly describe the Jews, right?
They've never
claimed to be in captivity. When have they ever claimed to be in captivity? When have they ever shown a consciousness of the captivity of the ancient Israelites? The Jews are just
They're only the essence. This is the essence of racial theology, these verses right here, that our race has had Yahweh's face hidden from us for hundreds of years because of our iniquity. And we went into captivity, and Jews reign over us. this is our race being talked about here. It's absolutely clear. And you can't even force Jews into these verses apart from being the ones that are going to be slaughtered. Then they stand out clearly. But clearly Israel here is not the Jews. So, yeah, it's good to be clear on that. But this is just a tremendous verse. I mean, he's spelling it all out here crystal clear so we don't miss it. And I'm gonna substitute the word nations for heathen here. And the nations shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them and gave them into the hand of their enemies. So fell they all by the sword, according to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions have I done unto them and hid my face from them. Therefore, thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob, and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel, and will be jealous for my holy name. After that they have borne their shame, and all their trespasses, whereby they have trespassed against me, when they dwelt safely in their land, and none made them afraid. When I have brought them again from the people, and gathered them out of their enemies' lands, and am sanctified in them in the sight of many nations. These are glorious verses. He's wrapping up here. The entire generation, the whole age, all the ages have been of our race have been designed to bring us to this point right here, where Yahweh unveils himself.
This is the entire message of hope to our race, and you accept
absolutely.
It, or you don't. But if you accept any part of the Bible, you have to accept this.
This makes perfect sense. I mean, this and the Book of Revelation are so related here. It's unbelievable how much they line up. But you know, you see here so much that Yahweh is all of our grief is because of our trespassing against Yahweh. Are ignoring his laws, you know, and you see how all of Judeo-Christianity, they don't even know that the law is still in effect. They're taught that the law was done away with at the cross.
Well, right,
they're in the age of grace. There's no law, you know. No wonder they can't see who Yahweh is, you know. No wonder they have no racial identity, understanding even who they are in this world, how unique their precious race is. And how they even despise their own race and welcome, you know, welcome race mixing into their race. It's the classic thing that the show that we did on Jeremiah 31, that the house of Israel and the house of Judah shall be sown with the seed of man and the seed of beast. It's the judgment of Yahweh on them.
Well, let's read Matthew 5:17. You should not believe that I have come to dismiss the law or the prophets. I have not come to dismiss, but to fulfill. 5:18, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth would pass, by no means should one iota or one stroke pass from the law until all things should happen. 5:19, indeed, he who may break the least of one of these commandments and teach men as much, Peter's, he shall be called least in the kingdom of the heavens. But he who should do and should teach, he shall be called great. And the kingdom of the heavens. The law is absolutely instrumental to our success and to our worthiness of being blessed by Yahweh.
Right.
No doubt.
I mean, you look what he says here in verse 24 of Ezekiel 39. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions have I done unto them and hid my face from them. I mean, if there's no law, then how do we even know what is uncleanness and what are our transgressions? I mean, Paul defines transgressions as not keeping the law. I mean, the law is clearly still upon Israel. It has not been done away with. There's no doubt whatsoever. And yet the mass amount of most of our race that call themselves Christians would think the complete opposite of this. So...
Well, absolutely. And now it's the Christian's duty to warn and to instruct our brethren of what is transpiring, why we're being flooded with aliens, why we have all these people on our land, why we're being bought out of our own businesses and homes, or foreclosed out of them, and we must witness to the truth of the gospel, even if we are told that they shall usually reject us.
Right, and I wonder how many Christians, maybe even how many of us, have really related the two matters of not keeping the law in our lands flooded with aliens, and how related those two things are here. You know, I mean, why is our nation being destroyed by alien races?
Is well, that's the blessings of obedience and,
yeah.
and the punishments of disobedience that we find
right.
in Deuteronomy and Leviticus. I mean, they're repeated in both books, right?
Yeah.
There's no getting around it. It's the natural law. It's not that we're bad and Yahweh looks down on us to punish us. It's basically that if we're bad, if we disregard his laws and commandments, the natural result of that is our punishment, because it's all cause and effect.
Right. And yet, in the providence of Yahweh, these alien races are not just part of our judgment, but in a sense, part of the final solution, where in his slaughter of them, he awakens his race to who he really is. It's quite sovereign and just eternal wisdom at work here. These are very exciting verses that we're in here.
Well, absolutely. The end of Ezekiel 39 tells us that we have all the promise in the world. All we have to do to partake of that promise is turn back to our God.
Right. Let me let's get through this chapter. Let me finish reading here. I left off at I'll start at verse 24. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions have I done unto them and hid my face from them. Therefore, thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel and will be jealous for my holy name. After that they have borne their shame and all their trespasses, whereby they have trespassed against me when they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid. When I have brought them again from the people and gathered them out of their enemies' lands and am sanctified in them in the sight of many nations, then shall they know that I am Yahweh, their Elohim, which caused them to be led into captivity among the nations. But I have gathered them unto their own land and have left none of them any more there. Neither will I hide my face any more from them, for I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith the Adonai Yahweh. Praise Yahweh. These are amazingly good verses.
Well, praise Yahweh. And that's Ezekiel 38 and 39. And thank you for being here with me tonight, Greg.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. And I'll be here tomorrow night on Yahweh's Covenant People at 8 o'clock alone, and I'm going to do part two of my exposition, Errors Inspired by Who, which is an exposition of the major mistranslations in the King James Version of the Bible and why we must look back at the original languages. And tomorrow I will discuss that even the translators of the King James Version of the Bible made that very same suggestion, or at least that their progeny did, that their scholastic progeny, that their Anglican Church progeny, let's put it that way. Okay, Greg, thank you. This is William Fink for Eli James and Christogenos. And thank you, everybody. Good night.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.